to 8. A long road it was, and a weary. Deep in fine sand, wherever there was shelter, while the gardens on the outskirts of Algiers, when at last they reached them, were desolation itself, with greenery all hanging limp, shattered and seared, but for the most part blown right off to lie in withering heaps. And from an outward turn on the mountain road, which gave them a clear view of the port and both harbours, it was clear to Stephen's searching telescope that Ringle was not there, snug against the mole. Nor was she in the offing. He barely had the heart to search the horizon for the larger, more conspicuous sails of surprise, yet he did so for a full minute before clapping his glass to with disappointment. "My dear Amos," he said some time later, "may I beg you to settle accounts with our guide and these good Turks, to give them a farewell feast at whatever place you judge most fit, together with a present, and then to join me at the consulate. I can see the roof and flagstaff from here." Jacob looked doubtful, but he agreed, and they parted at the next forking of the road. Stephen could hardly have missed his way, in spite of the anxiety, reasonable and unreasonable, that kept welling up in his heart, for this was the mare's own ground, and she increased her pace to a pleasant amble, threading her way through the increasing number of asses, camels, oxen and horses, until she brought him to the gate, gave him time to dismount, and then walked off to her own stable. In spite of his anxiety, Stephen had noticed an air of excitement in the city as he rode well into it, groups of people talking louder than usual, gazing about, making gestures whose meaning escaped him. So many people that sometimes they almost blocked the way, and the placid mare had to push through. No harsh words, however, excitement overcoming all other emotions. It's true that Stephen, who had retained his Sirocco headgear, didn't look at all out of the way. He was, however, at once recognised by the unfortunate young man in the outer office, who begged him to sit down. He would tell Lady Clifford at once. "Dear Dr. Matcheron," she cried, "how very glad I am to see you. Did you have an unspeakably horrid ride? I'm afraid so. A really shocking sirocco like that makes you long for the Yorkshire moors." "Certainly, but may I ask how Sir Peter does?" "Oh, very well indeed, I thank you. I've never seen such a change in him. No, nor known a better pill. I take two myself, one in the morning and one before bed. But will you not come and see him? He keeps his room because he has a great deal of work, and people are such a bore. Besides, his chief secretary's sick." The consul sprang up, not indeed quite like a lion, but very much more briskly than might have been expected in a man so recently crippled by what looked very like an exacerbated sciatica. "Dr. Matcheron," he cried, taking both Stephen's hands, "how very much obliged I am to you and your colleague for your precious remedies. I've scarcely thought about that shocking pain these last 3 days. Forgive me, my dear. Such a benign and healing purgation. Sit down, I beg. You must have had a cruel hard ride of it. Did you meet 2 or 3 squadrons of horse on your way back?" "No, sir. They must have taken the lower road. But tell me, how did your journey go? My dear," to Lady Clifford, "you will excuse us, will you not?" "Of course, of course. And if either of you could do with a pot of tea, pray touch the bell." "First," said Stephen, having opened the door for her, "may I ask what has become of the schooner Ringle? I have news of the very first consequence that I must communicate to Commodore Aubrey." "Alas, in the last stages of that frightful blow, the Commodore, signalling from an immense distance, called the schooner to him. I gathered from those who'd been talking to the corsairs who had managed to get in that a ship of the Royal Navy was dismasted and badly damaged, and Aubrey needed the schooner to help save her and tow her, presumably to Mahon. I'm very sorry to give you what I fear is very bad news." "It is bad news. About as bad as can be without some special dispensation. Let me tell you about my mission, and you shall judge. Dr. Jacob and I reached the hunting lodge in the Oasis. As you had told me, the day was not there, but pursuing lions farther on in the Atlas. But, as you had foretold, the vizier was there. I therefore showed him your letter and explained my errand." He's perfectly fluent in French, by the way. "He said that the rumour was completely unfounded, putting forward the religious differences and the day's hatred of Bonaparte. Finally, he suggested that I should speak to Omar Pasha himself and hear his even more convincing denial. This I did, now speaking through Jacob, And the Dey, too, said it was great nonsense. He reviled Bonaparte and spoke of his necessary downfall. He also spoke of his admiration for Sir Sidney Smith and the Royal Navy, and he invited me to lie in wait with him for a lion the next evening, using one of a very beautiful pair of rifles that he had recently acquired. Nothing of political consequence occurred until the next day, when he did indeed kill the lion, but only with his second barrel, so that when the wholly unexpected lioness charged, he was unarmed. I shot her dead at very short range. He was kind enough to say many flattering things, and he said that he should send the vizier a direct order that no gold should pass through Algiers, and on the return journey to the hunting lodge, looking by chance in my baggage, I found the rifle I had used concealed under my spare shirt. A little later, the Sirocco began to blow. It rapidly increased in strength, and we only reached the hunting lodge very late. The vizier was already in bed. Dr. Jacob was lodged with a former acquaintance, and, I think, fellow canine, who showed him the copy of a letter from the vizier to Sheikh Ibn Hazm.
The ruler who was to provide the pay for the Balkan mercenaries?
Just so. A letter requiring him to recall his caravan and load the treasure aboard one of the Dey Zeebeks at Arzila, just south and west of Tangier. The Zeebek was already on its way, and the captain's orders were to receive the treasure and repass the strait by night, with the strong eastward current and a favourable wind, steering for Durazzo with the utmost press of sail. It's the fastest Zeebek in all Barbary. This is the information that I wish to give the Commodore, so that he, who knows the strait so well, might intercept the vessel. I'm very sorry indeed that you should have found the Commodore out of immediate reach. I'm also very sorry to tell you that later this evening, or perhaps tomorrow, a new day will be proclaimed, Omar Pasha having by then been strangled by the executioners sent to the Kadna Valley with those squadrons I mentioned earlier. Strangled as his predecessor was strangled. He impaled one youth too many. An error in his calculations that I'd not reckoned upon. Sir Peter touched the bell. The tea appeared, and when Stephen had drunk a sip, he asked, "Do you suppose the vizier was privy to this usurpation?" "I've no doubt of it at all. In the first place, they were wholly incompatible. The vizier despised Omar Pasha as an illiterate brute, and the Dey despised the vizier as a cot queen. In spite of his numerous harem, his collection of guns, and his status as an important shareholder in the larger associations of corsairs. Furthermore, the vizier privately admired Bonaparte, and privately stood to receive a huge commission on Ibn Hazm's gold. But even in so small a court as that of Algiers, privacy, real privacy, scarcely exists. I can do favours on occasion, and I have a number of voluntary informants." "I don't think I know the word cot queen," said Stephen. "Perhaps it is rather out of use now, but we lived in a remote part of Yorkshire, and my grandfather often used it. Most of his neighbours were cot queens, particularly those that didn't choose to hunt the fox or hare. He meant that they were somewhat effeminate, given to embroidery and probably to sodomy, little better than whigs." After some moments of reflection, Stephen said, "I grieve for Omar Pasha. He had some excellent qualities. He was truly generous, and I did him a shameful injustice." "Come in," called the consul. "Sir," said the messenger, "you told me to warn you the moment the schooner was seen. Musa believes she is just hull up in the north." "Shall we go and see?" asked Sir Peter. "I have a telescope on the roof." "Will your poor leg bear you? It's done so ever since the Ringle vanished." The roof, like almost all the others in the city, was whitened against the heat of the sun with tiles or lime wash, and the mass of them gave the impression of some superhuman bleaching field. But Stephen's whole attention was fastened upon the fine, stout telescope that stood on a bronze tripod, weighed down and steadied by pigs of lead. Beside it stood a small black boy in a scarlet fez, smiling with triumph. Sir Peter hurried over, bent double against the wind, but moving even more nimbly than when he'd climbed the ladder, and inwardly Stephen swore to abide by no obvious diagnosis for the rest of his life.
"'She's certainly fore and aft rigged,' said Sir Peter. "'But this damned wind does so blur the image. "'Come and look. Here's the focusing knob.' "'Stephen peered with lowered head, cupping his eye with both hands. "'The air was indeed horribly troubled. "'A little whiteness came, grew almost clear, "'then utterly dissolved in shimmer. "'I wish I had a smaller eyepiece,' said Sir Peter. "'This atmosphere will not cope with such a magnification.' "'I have her!' cried Stephen. "'I have her! "'But alas, she's not Ringle. "'She's a craft with a lateen, "'and she's losing ground on every tack. "'I'm so sorry,' said the consul. "'So very sorry. "'But at least it shows that some hopes of approaching exist. "'Let's sleep on that, and conceivably the morning "'will find her snugly in her berth by the mole. "'Sir Peter!' called ahead at foot level. The speaker standing precariously on the wind-shaken ladder. Dr. Jacobs sends his compliments, and could he be received? Sir Peter, said Stephen, I ask your pardon for interfering, but my colleague, though an excellent physician, God forgive us both, he added mentally, and linguist, is no mariner. Pray, let us go down and speak to him in safety. By all means, said the consul. And he gave Stephen a hand over the dreadful gulf between the parapet of the roof and the ladderhead. "'Sir Peter,' cried Jacob, starting up, "'I do beg your pardon for this intrusion, "'but I thought you would like to know "'that the lot has fallen on Ali Bay.' "'Not on Mustafa? "'I'm amazed.' "'So was he, sir. "'And I fear it is the bowstring for him. "'He was led away. "'But I ventured to come in this informal manner "'to tell you that Ali is to be proclaimed "'immediately after the evening prayer.' "'I'm very much obliged to you indeed, Dr. Jacob. "'And, as I said, I'm amazed. "'Of all the candidates, Ali was the most in favour of the Allies "'and opposed to Bonaparte. "'Perhaps I'd misread the situation.' "'He pondered and then went on. "'And I should be still more obliged "'if you and Dr. Maturin would go on my behalf. "'It's still generally understood "'that my health keeps me within doors. "'To be the first to congratulate the new day.' We have all the proper ceremonial garments here, and after that I hope you'll both stay with Lady Clifford and me until the wretched south wind dies enough for your ships to come in. These blasts are very rare, but once they've set in doggedly, they usually last 6 or 7 days. Though now I come to think of it, I shall go with you. I shall take a stick and you two will support me. That'll be a capital stroke. Jacob glanced at Stephen, saw assent in his eye, and having coughed, he said, "'Sir, we should be very happy to support you as being your known physicians. "'But as for your exceedingly kind and handsome invitation, "'for my part, may I be allowed to decline. "'Having uttered all the necessary words of congratulations, "'I should like to retire to an obscure lodging house near the Gate of Woe, "'a house in which some of my less presentable Algerine and Berber friends "'would excite no comment.' "'Whereas they might well compromise an official residence. "'By all means,' said the consul. "'And Dr. Maturin shall do just as he pleases, "'dining and spending the night with us "'and walking about with you by day, "'meeting your, no doubt, very interesting friends, "'and I'm sure watching barometer and the horizon "'with as much zeal as Isabel and myself, or even more. "'The divan will take place at about 7, I suppose. "'Just so.' Within the half hour following the proclamation. The city, in a state of intense yet still somewhat restrained excitement, grew wonderfully calm for the evening prayer. Almost nothing but the voice of the south wind and the palm trees. But the last pious words were barely said, the little prayer carpets were hardly rolled, before the enormous roaring blast of the Algerine batteries saluted the sky. And as the last echoes died away, thousands upon thousands of Janissaries and of all those citizens who valued their well-being bawled out the name of Ali, competing with countless harsh trumpets and with drums of every pitch. The city now settled down to open merriment and joy and endless conversation across the narrow streets or the full width of the few great squares, and Sir Peter's coach and four made its slow but discreetly magnificent way to the palace. Here, the consuls, physicians, were handed out, gorgeous in their robes, and they supported Sir Peter into the council chamber where the new day greeted him.
the first representative of any foreign state to appear, with great kindness, sending for a particularly deep cushioned seat for him, and listening with grave satisfaction to Jacob's fluent, sonorous, and no doubt elegant Turkish congratulation interspersed with Persian verse and proverb. An excellent speech, and above all one that didn't last too long. When it was finished, and when Stephen had presented the ritual sabre, the Dey returned thanks, calling the blessing of heaven and peace on King George. He then clapped his hands, and four powerful black men carried Sir Peter in his padded chair to the carriage, amidst a triple blast of trumpets sustained beyond anything that Stephen had heard in his life. By this time it was dark, and the steady horses made their way through fireworks, cheering crowd, bonfires with children leaping over them, and great numbers of muskets being fired into the air, the smoke, alas, still racing northward, perhaps even faster than before. "Lord," said Stephen, as he and Jacob, having changed into more everyday clothes, walked downstairs to dinner at the consulate, "such an overwhelming wealth of colour, light, noise and emotion I don't think I've ever known before. Nor had I known that there were anything like so many people in all Africa Minor. Yet, in spite of the dreadful underlying anxiety about surprise and wrinkle, the dreadfully swift passage of time, I do not find that the tumult has quite destroyed my appetite. Even if it had done so, I believe my news would deal with the situation. Sidi Hafiz, whom I have known these many, many years, told me that great masses of the Russian horse, foot and artillery were blocked by floods in Podolia. The vanguard is waiting for them, so that the dangerous proximity, the time when our assassins, our Bonapartist Balkan Muslims, can strike at both, causing hopeless confusion, ill will, delay, mistrust and the like, is postponed for at least a week. This came in a wholly reliable overland message from Turkey. "Thank heaven for that," cried Stephen. "I've been watching the calendar, seeing this wretched month advance so briskly, and every change in that vile moon shape has wrenched my heart. You have indeed grown much thinner these last days. I shall eat like a lion tonight, however. A whole week gained. Thank you so very much for telling me, dear Amos. Perhaps they'll give us mutton." Lady Clifford's dinner did indeed include mutton. Boiled mutton, in the English manner, with caper sauce. It was well enough in its way for those used to such dishes. And after several other delights, it was followed by a really stout, solid pudding, of which the same might be said. But it couldn't really compare with the tender lamb roasted or grilled on skewers in Jacob's obscure quarters near the Gate of Woe. Stephen ate there daily when he was not staring at the horizon or walking about Algiers with Jacob. But in the evening he returned to the consulate to dine with the Cliffords. It was on one of these days, these as it were free days, which a kind fate had added to their calendar, that Jacob and he were passing through the now active, reanimated slave market, when Jacob, catching sight of an acquaintance, begged Stephen to wait for him. By heredity, Jacob was a jewel merchant, and the profession, still slumbering in his bosom, was always ready to awake. He'd retained not only an intimate knowledge of gemstones, but a fervent love for some of them, and he wished this acquaintance to exchange a small, exquisite jasper bowl for some few of the paper of moderate diamonds that he habitually carried, very well hidden, to provide for such a deal. "I shall not be long," he said. "Let us meet at the blue-domed coffee-house there in the far corner." "Certainly," said Stephen. And as he was wandering slowly through this ultimate unhappiness and desolation, rendered just tolerable from being so customary, a fact of everyday life, like a cattle market, when he heard a voice, lost in misery, said, "Oh, for the love of God," in Irish. Not at all loud, with no strong emphasis, he turned and saw two small children, a boy and a girl, ugly, dirty and thin. They were far too young for the usual chains, but they were tied together, left arm to right arm, by a piece of string. The cheerful merchant called out to Stephen, first in Arabic, then in a mostly Spanish lingua franca, that he should have them for a trifle. They were perfectly healthy, and in a very few years, if fed moderately, they would be capable of severe labour. Even now, ha-ha, they could be put to scare crows, and they could always be used for pleasure. "I shall speak to them," said Stephen, and this he did. "They were twins," said the boy. "Kevin and Mona Fitzpatrick, from Ballydonegan, where their father worked for Mr. McCarthy. They had gone to Dersey Island with Cousin Rory in the boat for crabs. Somehow, with the great wind and the rain from the north, the boat came adrift while Rory was with his sweetheart, and they were swept out to sea. In the morning, the corsairs, the Moors, took them aboard. They'd been raiding along the coast, but they'd brought away only one man, Sean Kelly. And the gentleman there," nodding at the merchant, "had sold him yesterday. Sean had told them that the people of Dungarvan and somewhere to the north had killed 24 Moors. A person with a somewhat bookish, secretarial look, a person whom Stephen might well have seen among the new day's retinue, spoke privately to the merchant, who listened with obvious respect. And when he'd gone, Stephen said, in the usual indifferent horsecoper's tone, 'I should like to know what kind of a price such goods fetch in this city.' The merchant replied, 4 guineas for the boy, sir, the usual redemption fee, and I'll throw in the girl for the honour of your custom.' 'Very well,' said Stephen, feeling in his pocket, 'but you must give me a receipt.' The merchant bowed, wrote on a piece of paper, sealed it, received the coins, cut the piece of string, and formally passed the children over with the customary blessing and a second bow. Stephen returned the civility, told the children that he had bought them, and bade each take a hand. This they did without a word, and he led them across the market to the Blue Dome. 'Amos,' he said, 'do you think that the people of this house would have something suitable for children? I've just bought these two. Have they teeth? Kevin and Mona, have you teeth?' They nodded very gravely and showed them. Fine, healthy teeth, with the gaps usual at their age. 'Then I shall call for yoghurt, sugared, and soft bread. Pray, what was the language in which you spoke to them?' 'It was Irish, the language spoken by many, if not by most, of the people in Ireland.' Jacob waved his hand, gave his order, and asked, 'Do these children speak no English?' 'I will ask them when there is a little food in their bellies. They might weep if they were questioned before.' How it vanished, the yoghurt and the great soft flap of bread! Within minutes the children looked far more nearly human. And on being asked after a second helping, Mona said that although she didn't know much, she could say most of a Hail Mary. Kevin only hung his head. 'Do you think that kind woman by the gate of woe would wash these children, clothe them in modest decency, and even brush their hair?' 'Fatima. I'm sure of it. She might find them shoes, too.' 'I doubt they've ever worn shoes.' He asked them, and they both shook their heads. 'Not even for mass.' Renewed shaking and a hint of tears. 'I know what might answer very well,' said Stephen. 'Those shoes we call espardenas, made of sailcloth, with soft cord soles and ribbons to attach them. Are they to be had, do you think? I shouldn't like to carry them to the consulate barefoot.' 'Certainly they are to be had. At the southern corner of this very square they're to be had. In these shoes, red for the one, blue for the other, they hobbled with ludicrous pride to Amos Jacob's dubious lair. By the time they reached it, they were walking quite easily, and their starved little faces were more nearly human, even ready to smile. Fatima, a capable, intelligent woman, looked at them with more sorrow than disapproval. After a longish pause, she brought them back washed, clothed, brushed, fed yet again, and almost unrecognisable, but perfectly willing to be friendly. 'They're brisker by far,' said Stephen. 'Do you notice that the sound of the wind is less? But they would never walk up all those infernal steps. Would there be carriages to be had, do you suppose?' 'Certainly there are carriages to be had, and I will send Ahmed for one if you wish.' Pray be so kind. And certainly I have noticed a lessening in the perpetual roar. It clenched one's innermost man, diaphragm, solar plexus, pericardium, into a hard knot that is now perceptibly looser. If we take a carriage, we shall have to go a great way round to reach the consulate, and for two-thirds of the journey we shall be gazing over the sea. Sea there was. A vast extent of white-flecked sea, with its horizon growing more and more distant as they rose. But the whole of it was still empty even by the time they reached the consulate. Stephen left the wondering children with Jacob under the palms and walked in. He was told that Sir Peter was at a consular meeting, but, smiling at the news, he sent his name up to Lady Clifford. "Oh, Dr. Maturin," she cried, "I'm so sorry Sir Peter's not at home. He's at one of those odious conferences that go on and on forever, and all to no purpose." "I grieve for him, upon my word," said Stephen, "but my errand is rather to you than to him. I bought a couple of children this morning in the slave market, a boy and a girl, twins of, I suppose, 6 or 7. Although they do not speak a word of English beyond the Hail Mary, they are literally distressed British subjects. They were picked up by an Algerine corsair that had been raiding the Munster coast, picked up in a drifting boat, brought here and sold. May I beg you to shelter them for 2 or 3 days while I make arrangements to send them home? Dr. Maturin," she said, without any change of expression or tone that he could detect, "I wish I could oblige you, but children are my husband's aversion, his absolute aversion. He cannot bear them. I'm told that is often the case with men. It's like some people with cats. He cannot tolerate them anywhere in the house. But if, as I suppose, from their origin and from what you say they're Roman Catholics, then I believe the Redemptorist fathers are the people to apply to." "Many thanks, Your Ladyship," said Stephen, rising. "My compliments wait on Sir Peter." Outside, cheerfully greeted by his slaves, who showed him a palm frond torn from the tree, he saw with great satisfaction that Jacob had retained the carriage. "I came on a fool's errand," he said. "Lady Clifford does not choose to house the children." I was truly astonished at her frankness. "Were you, though?" asked Jacob, looking at him curiously. "Nevertheless, we shall be perfectly happy at our lodging house, but I'm sorry for your disappointment." It was a disappointment, however, and it shook his faith in his own judgment to a remarkable degree. He sent a note excusing himself from dinner and spent a pleasant evening feeding the children. Ingenuous little creatures, with Fatima. Jacob was away, visiting a Lebanese cousin, who also dealt in gemstones, though on a much larger scale, and in negotiating loans. Coming back when Stephen was in bed, he asked him whether he was asleep. "I am not," said Stephen. "Then let me tell you that my cousin has had news that Ibn Hazim's caravan began its return only yesterday. It is difficult country, and they will need 10 days to reach Asgar, let alone the little port whose name escapes me. Arzila, I think. Arzila, indeed. So, with our blessed days of grace, I believe we have a fortnight and to spare." "That's very good news indeed. I rejoice. And Abdul Reis, the head of one of the corsair groups, says that the wind will diminish tomorrow. If we like to see some of his galleys, we should be welcome at the inner harbour, but quite early in the day, because if the wind does as he thinks it will, he may set out for Sardinia before noon. There are advantages in being well seen by the day."
"Certainly. Listen, Amos, did you ever read an author who said, 'Never underestimate a woman's capacity for jealousy, however illogical or inconsistent or indeed self-defeating'?"
"I don't think so. But the notion is fairly widespread among those who think of men and women as belonging to two different nations and who wish to be profound. Nevertheless, Lady Clifford's behaviour puzzled Stephen, and until he fell asleep, he turned and returned it in his mind with no satisfactory answer at all. He was awakened at dawn, not by any of the usual noises of a disorderly house, nor by Dr. Jacob's steady, persevering snore, but by a little girl's voice in his ear, asking whether there were any cows to be milked. There were not. But there was water to be drawn with Fatima's help, faces to be washed, prayers to be said, and a perfectly delightful breakfast to be eaten. Bananas and dates amazed the children, in a little hidden court behind. Soft bread toasted on the brazier that at some distance kept the coffee warm, toasted and spread with honey. "Are you not cold, children, with nothing but shirts?" he asked. "Not at all. And they're not just ordinary shirts, but proper clothes." "Ahmed, though quite old, has nothing else," they replied. "Here's the other gentleman. Good morning, sir. God be with you." Jacob gave them a Hebrew blessing, drank a great draught of coffee, and said to Stephen, "When you had gone to bed, a parcel came for you. I didn't choose to wake you, but there it is in our room. I shall bring it down as soon as I am more nearly myself." How very much better these children look after a night's sleep. You could hardly mistake them for half-starved apes any more. In a little while, his good nature returning, Jacob fetched the parcel forwarded from the consulate. Hardly a parcel in the Western sense. No paper, no string, but a somberly gorgeous robe lapped about with silk scarves, enveloping the rifle with which Stephen had killed the lioness. Attached to it was a letter with the vizier's elegant explanation of a mistake among the people of the baggage train, his well-turned apologies, and his hope that if the loss had been mentioned to his present highness, the return might also be noticed. And after the European signature came a far more beautiful passage of Arabic. "Please would you read this for me?" asked Stephen. "It is a blessing, a series of blessings on you and yours, mentioning many of the attributes of God, the merciful, the compassionate. My impression is that the vizier was so sure that his friend Mustafa would be elected that he could do whatever he chose to do with impunity, and that he has now delivered himself to you, bound hand and foot." Stephen considered, nodded, and then, bringing out another paper, he said, "And may I beg you to read this as well? It acknowledges receipt of 4 English gold coins of adequate weight in payment for 2 young Franks, male and female, warranted virgin. It is dated, sealed and signed in due form. Thank you. I didn't want them to be snatched away, reclaimed. They've had quite enough to bear as it is." He looked with intense admiration at his rifle for a while, and then asked when they were to meet Abdul Reis the corsair. "We could go whenever you choose. The inner harbour is only a few steps from the Gate of Woe. And the children can come too. I shall confide this to the good Fatima's care," tapping the wrapped-up gun, "and then we can go." The street was extremely narrow and the balconies almost touched overhead. Parts of it were encumbered with sheep, goats, horsemen and Algerine children playing a game that required a great deal of running and screeching. Many of them looked remarkably like Mona and Kevin, who were of the black-haired Irish, and they wore the same kind of tunics. Then, working past 3 heavily laden and exceptionally ill-natured camels, Stephen, Jacob and the children were suddenly through the gate, and there was the great sky above them and the sea stretching away and away, wind whitened still, but much less so, and just this side of its northern limit, Ringle, beating in for the shore just visible from the inner harbour's wall, unrecognisable to one who knew her very well. The children shied extremely at the sight of the galleys that filled the inner port. They fell silent, and each grasped one of Stephen's hands. The Reis, a formidable great red-bearded figure, was markedly affable to Jacob, showing him the arrangement and the ordering of his handsome craft. He would almost certainly set out for Sardinia when the sailmaker brought the new lateen. "They do not mean to row, then?" asked Stephen, when this had been explained to him. "Oh, no. They only use their oars when the wind doesn't serve. At present it serves perfectly for any voyage to a little north of east, to north itself, and a little north of west, particularly as the seas are diminishing every half hour. Dear Amos, pray ask him whether that vessel on the horizon that is turning so valiantly into the wind will eventually reach this port." Jacob's question to the Reis was interrupted by the coming of the coal-black sailmaker with 2 pale Sclavonians, lightly chained but heavily burdened, But eventually, when the new lateen was bent to its long, long tapering yard, Abdul looked out to sea, smiled at the sight of her coming about so briskly on the larboard tack, and said, "The little American schooner. I've seen her before. The frigate's tender. Yes, with the wind lessening like this, she may get in by moonrise. In the early part of the night, at all events." Stephen said, "Jacob, if I do not mistake, she will soon be almost exactly in the galley's path, steering for Sardinia. If the Reis would put us aboard her, I will give him any sum you think proper. These few hours are so very precious. I am so nearly certain of it that I shall hurry back, settle with Fatima, and bring our belongings," said Jacob. He made the request with joined hands, received an amiable smile, and hurried away. Orders, cries, in much the same peremptory tone usual in the Royal Navy, but sometimes with an additional Moorish howl. And as soon as Jacob, helped by Ahmed, had put their meagre luggage aboard, the galley began its smooth glide towards the harbour's mouth. The silent children stood pressed against Stephen's side, for although this was not a raiding voyage with the galley full of boarders, but an ordinary mercantile carrying and fetching of goods, the diminished crew was still made up of right corsairs for whom an habitual brutish ferocity of expression was as much a part of their equipment as the knives and pistols in their belts. The open sea. The Reis put the helm amidships, loosed the sheet, and attended to Jacob's further explanation. His red beard opened in a laugh, and he said, "If your friend will guarantee that the schooner will not fire upon us, I will put you aboard, for the love of God." When this was relayed to him, Stephen bowed repeatedly to the Reis, and said to Jacob, "Could I climb onto some eminence and wave, let us say, a handkerchief, when we're nearer, to show our peaceable intent?" "By all means, if you can find a suitable eminence, and remain firmly attached to it in spite of all this heinous pitching." Stephen gazed about the unfamiliar rigging. There was a sort of box above the masthead, but there seemed no way up to it but levitation. The shrouds, to be sure, had ratlins so that one could climb, as on a ladder, but there was a shocking gap between the topmost ratlin and the box. Practicable, perhaps, for an ape or a hardened corsair, but not for a doctor of physic. "I shall stand in the prow, watching with my pocket-glass, and when we're close enough, I shall make antic gestures." The bows of a galley running before the wind didn't prove much of a vantage point, particularly as the children, who would not be left, tangled themselves in the woolded bumpkin. So all three wedged themselves fairly comfortably along what forward rail the galley possessed, and Stephen showed them the wonders of his little telescope. This occupied them until the two vessels were so close that he could distinctly make out William Reed's gleaming steel hook holding him to the starboard shrouds of Ringle's foremast. Stephen inwardly prayed that nothing might go wrong now, and waved his handkerchief. The young master's mate, standing behind the schooner's captain with a much more powerful glass, instantly reported this, and Reed waved back. Stephen told the children to stand up. Their presence would explain the situation, and only by the grace of God did he prevent them from tumbling into the sea as the galley pitched. However, their good, stout shirts held fast, and he hauled them in, gasping and ashamed. The tedious hours that had dragged by with so little apparent gain since the morning suddenly hastened their pace. Faces could be seen and recognised, voices heard. Stephen hurried aft, untied his parcel, wrapped the gun in some shirts and a pair of long woollen drawers, and clasped the vizier's gorgeous robe to his bosom. As the two vessels kissed gently together, the Ringles made the galley fast and thrust across a brow for their unreliable surgeon, who, before venturing upon it, crabwise with a child in each hand, presented the splendid garment to Abdul with a flow of heartfelt thanks, translated by Jacob. "Why, sir, and here you are," cried Reed,
heaving him inboard. "How very happy I am to see you, and how happy the Commodore will be. He's been fairly eating his heart out in Mahon. Goodbye, sir," this to Abdul Reis, "and many, many thanks to you and your beautiful galley." These last words and the Reis's reply were lost as the two vessels separated. Ringle, heading for Minorca and the galley for Sardinia, but they went on waving until they were out of sight. "These children," said Stephen, "are Mona and Kevin Fitzpatrick from Munster. Mona, make your bob to the captain. Kevin, make your leg." This in Irish. "And corsairs picked them up in a boat off the coast, carried them back and sold them in the slave market here. I bought them, and I mean to send them home in the next ship commanded by a friend and bound for the Cove of Cork. As soon as we're aboard Surprise, Paul will look after them. But where can we stow them here, and what can we feed them on? Oh, we've plenty of milk, fresh eggs and vegetables. Well, fairly fresh, we having beaten into this hellish wind so long. But edible, and as for sleeping, we'll sling a cot in the cabin. These two will fit into it with room to spare. Perhaps they could now be given something in the galley and be shown the heads. I perceive a certain uneasiness familiar to me from my youth." "By all means," said Reed. "Do they speak English?" "Scarcely a word. But they've picked up a surprising amount of Arabic," said Stephen, looking at Jacob, who nodded. "Then I shall pass the word for Berry. He has children of his own, and he was a slave in Morocco for some years." The word was passed, the children led away by a kindly seaman, rather old, and Stephen said, "But may I be forgiven, William? First things first, for all, love. Tell me about Surprise and the Commodore." "The coffee's ready, sir. Should you like to drink it in the cabin?" asked his steward. "Certainly. Doctor, shall we go below?" He collected his wits as he poured the coffee, and then said, "Late in the afternoon of the day that horrible blow began, the Commodore was far out in the offing helping a disabled ship, Lion, totally dismasted, but for about 10 foot of the mizzen, and we could just distinguish his signal calling us out. So we slipped moorings, struck to gallant masts down on deck, roused out our heavy weather canvas and cleared the harbour. Very soon we were reduced to a storm forestaysail and a few other scraps. When we arrived, guided by minute guns, we could scarcely see 50 yards for the sand and the flying spray, but we did make out that Surprise had managed to pass Lion a tow to get her head round a little so that she might recover some of her wreckage and set up a jury rig to give her at least steerage way. I passed under his lee for orders, and while he was telling me what to do, a heavy Dutchman, part of a scattered convoy, came hurtling down under little more than bare poles, saw us at the last moment, clapped his helm a lee, severed the tow and struck Surprise just abaft the starboard cathead, carrying away her bowsprit, heads, her forefoot, much of her gripe, and starting God knows how many butt ends. They listened, amazed. They both knew enough of the sea and of that particular blast to have some notion of the appalling situation of the three ships in question. They shook their heads but said nothing. It's difficult to believe that we survived those God knows how many days, but at least Ringle could carry and fetch, and we were all fairly well supplied. And luckily the weather, though as foul as can be imagined, wasn't cold. Luckily, for all the beds aboard Surprise had to be stuffed into those shocking started butts, where the sea came pouring in for the first 2 days, in spite of all the fothering in the world. The bows of sharp-built craft are very, very hard to follow. It was a rough time with the pumping alone, and I've never seen so much grog drunk with so little effect. And the people, at least our people, behaved very well, never a cross word. In time, Lion did manage a tolerable jury rig, enough to give her 5 knots. The wind and our leaks grew a little less wicked, and we limped into Mahon on Tuesday morning, making a perfect landfall. We landed our wounded, strains, hernias and falling blocks mostly. The Commodore had Ringle surveyed. They pronounced her fit. We took some stores aboard, and with the wind veering just enough to let us out of Mahon,
He sent me off to fetch you, while he and all the shipwrights who could be spared from Lyon laboured on repairing supplies right round the clock. We went with a heavy heart. Heavier still when the wind shifted right back into the south and we thought we should never see Africa again. Nor did I think I should ever again bless a southerly gale, though this one's all a man could wish. Indeed, it was now the kindest breeze. And late the next morning it wafted them up the long, long inlet to Port Mahon, where the naval yard echoed with the caulker's mallets thundering upon the Lion's hull. But out in the fairway there rode Surprise, apparently as trim as ever she had been, with her captain in a boat under her newly painted bows, telling his joiner just where to place the last rectangles of gold leaf on her upper forefoot. As soon as he was aware of the Ringle's presence, he sent his joiner up the side, spun the boat about and pulled rapidly across the harbour. He was in the plainest of working clothes, but the Ringles had seen him from afar, and he was received with all the ceremonial honours that any commodore has a right to, and with much more pleasure and goodwill than most. "A very hearty welcome to you all," he cried. "I never thought to have seen you so soon, with a full gale so steady in the south." "Nor you would not have seen us, sir," said William Reed, "but for an uncommon blessing. We could make no headway at all, turned and turned just in sight of Algiers, losing ground on every tack the last day or so. But a corsair galley came racing out full before the wind, her lateens hair-eared on either side, and she was carrying Dr. Maturin and his slaves and Dr. Jacob." "Doctors," said Jack, shaking their hands, "how very glad I am to see you. Come back to the ship with me and we'll all have dinner together. Some guests are coming, among them the Admiral, and we've been prettying our fore and aft." "Mona," said Stephen, "make your bobs with the Commodore. Kevin, make your leg." Jack bowed to each in return and said, "These are your slaves, I presume?"
"Just so," said Stephen. "May I be allowed to take them with us and confide them to Paul?"
"Of course you may," said Jack. "William, if you bring Ringle alongside, I think it would be better than in and out of boats." It was very like a homecoming, and as he gazed about the spotless deck, the impeccable exactitude of the yards and the gleaming paint, to say nothing of the extreme brilliance of every piece of metal that could be induced to shine, Stephen felt that he might have been aboard the frigate fresh from Sepping's Yard and Madeira, lying within the new mole and waiting for the visit of the Commander-in-Chief and Lady Keith, rather than on a vessel that had undergone a battering so severe that she very nearly went down with all hands. It was true that Jack Aubrey looked 20 years older and quite thin, that the traces of extreme hard labour and fatigue were evident on most of the faces, the smiling faces that he saw, and that the grey, bowed figure that approached touched his hat and said, "I give you joy of your return, sir," remained unrecognised until he spoke. "Killick," he cried, detaching himself from Mona and shaking his hand, "I hope I see you well."
"I ain't complaining, sir, and you look tolerable spry, if I may take the liberty, which I've laid out your decent clothes in the bed-place. Must I change?"
"You would never wish to bring discredit on the barkie with all that filth." Killick pointed to some odd patches of rifle oil here and there. "The Admiral's dining aboard."
Stephen bowed to the inevitable and said, "Killick, please do me another kindness and take these children to Paul with my compliments. Beg her to wash, brush and rig them in a suitable manner. Feed them on whatever is appropriate, and above all, be very kind and gentle with them. They don't speak any English yet, but Gagan will interpret."
"Kind and gentle, sir?"
He sniffed and added,
"Well, I shall give the message."
Stephen explained all this to the children, but he doubted that they, with so many new and extraordinary experiences, sights, so many strange people, even partially understood his words. However, they did each give Killick a hand and followed him to the after hatchway, from which they cast back a wan and anxious look.
He found Jack and Harding looking most attentively at the new accommodation ladder shipped for their illustrious guests.
"Jack," he said, "forgive me, but I must have a word with you. You'll excuse me, Mr. Harding."
In the cabin, he went on, "I've been bursting with my news. There was not a single fit moment aboard the Ringle. As you know very well, one of the prime objects of our voyage was to prevent gold reaching the Adriatic Muslims."
Jack nodded.
"The then Dey agreed not to let it pass by way of Algiers, but he's been murdered and betrayed. The gold is now aboard a very rapid vessel in the port of Arzila. Is now, or very soon will be, aboard. This vessel, a galley, as I recall, is to attempt the passage of the strait by night with a favourable wind. Is it reasonable that we should lie here inactive? I knew the facts in Algiers, and it almost killed me, being unable to tell you because of that cruel south wind and the days passing, passing. How well I understand your pain, dear Stephen," said Jack, laying a hand on his shoulder. "But you must recollect that these same southerly gales have been blowing elsewhere, even far west of the Canaries. They've kept almost all shipping on the west coast of Spain and Portugal in port, and even stout new-built ships of the line didn't attempt the strait and its wicked lee shore until last Monday. Your Moorish galley or Zeebeck would never, never have ventured out in such seas. Take comfort, brother. Drink up a little glass of gin to restore your appetite and enjoy your dinner. The Admiral's coming, and his politico, and your friend Mr. Wright. He's often asked after you."
"You relieve my mind wonderfully, Jack."
Stephen sat breathing deeply for a while. He looked so pale that Jack poured his gin at once, added a squeeze of lemon, and urged him to get it down in little sips before he changed. Before the glass was empty, someone knocked at the cabin door. It was Simpson, the ship's barber, with a fresh white apron and jug of hot water.
"Simpson, sir," he said, "which Killick thought the doctor might like a shave."
Stephen ran his hand over his chin, as men will do on such occasions. Even popes have been known to make the same gesture, and he acquiesced. It was, therefore, a smooth, brushed and quite well-dressed Dr. Maturin who stood there on deck just before the appointed hour, behind the Commodore, his First Lieutenant and the Officer of the Royal Marines, all equally smooth and all in their splendour. Blue and gold for the sailors, scarlet and gold for the soldiers. As the more conscientious clocks of Mahon prepared to strike the hour, Admiral Fanshawe stepped from a coach, followed by his secretary and political adviser, and before he set foot on deck, hats flew off, the boatswain sounded his call, and the marines presented arms with a perfectly simultaneous crash. Sometime after this, an aged, shabby gentleman, wearing the clothes of another age and followed by two porters carrying a copper tube, wandered hesitantly towards the accommodation ladder. Mounting it with some difficulty, he said to the officer of the deck, "Sir, my name is Wright. Captain Aubrey was so kind as to invite me, but I fear I may be a little late."
"Not at all, sir," said Hewell. "May I show you the way to the cabin and unburden your men? Wilcox, Price, come and take this tube, will you?"
"You're too kind," said Mr. Wright, and he followed Hewell aft. But the two porters would not be unburdened. They carried right on with their tube, entering the already somewhat crowded great cabin with their tube, and thrust it across the table, regardless of cloth, glasses and silver, saying loud and clear, "One and fourpence, sir, if you please." "Hey," cried Mr. Wright, from the midst of his conversation with the Commodore and Dr. Maturin, "one and fourpence, or we carry it away." Harding whipped round the table, gave them half a crown, and in a low, very, very vicious tone desired them to get out of the ship. Killick and his mate Grimble, together with the more presentable gunroom servants, smoothed the snowy cloth, rearranged the glasses and silver, and watched as Mr. Wright, wholly unconscious of inconvenience, untimeliness and fuss, unsealed one end of the tube, gave the other to the Commodore to hold, and withdrew the gleaming narwhal's horn, perfect in its curves and spirals, without a hint of repair.
"I cannot detect the slightest join," cried Stephen. "It's a masterpiece. Thank you, sir. Thank you very much indeed." All this, to the bitter grief of the Commodore's cook, had delayed the beginning of dinner quite shockingly. But in time they were all seated, Jack at the head of the table, Admiral Fanshawe on his right, then Reed, the Marine officer, the Admiral's secretary, Harding at the foot, then Stephen with Mr. Wright next to him, then came the Admiral's political adviser, and lastly, Dr. Jacob. A pretty large party for so small a frigate, but with the table set athwartships and the guns trundled into the coach and the sleeping cabin, it could be done. And done it was, with great success. The news of the Horn's perfect restoration, of its being in an even finer state of beauty than before, Mr. Wright, with his delicate burrs and buffs, having given it the gleam of fine old ivory, spread rapidly through the frigate. The ship's luck was aboard again. Killick's unattractive, shrewish face beamed once more. His messmates, he'd very nearly been expelled from their society, smiled, winked and nodded at him in the cabin, and slapped him on the back as he travelled to and from the galley. Good humour is a charmingly infectious state anywhere, particularly aboard a ship that has recently had a very rough time of it and that is now in port, moored fore and aft. The conversation at table very soon rose to a fine volume of sound, and Mr. Wright had to strain his quavering old voice to give Stephen an account of the many mathematical calculations and even advanced physical studies in a current of strongly flowing water to determine the effect of the narwhal horn spirals and tori on the animal's progress, all to no effect. No effect yet. But so important a process must have a function, almost certainly a hydrodynamic function, and either plodding science or one of those beautiful intuitions, or perhaps Mr. Wright should say sudden illuminations, would give the solution. Harding and the Admiral's secretary agreed very well, and although the Royal Marine found it difficult to get beyond an uncommon foundation to William Reed on his left, they somehow discovered that they'd both been at Mr. Willis's school together when they were little boys. And from that moment on, except when common good manners required that they should say something to their other neighbours or drink a glass of wine with an acquaintance on the other side of the table, it was a series of "Oh, Thomas and the Mad Bulldog," of "How kindly the maids would hand out yesterday's cold suet pudding from the back windows of the kitchen," of "The famous thrashing Smith Major had given Hubble." The Admiral had known Jack time out of mind, and they had a great deal of naval news and recollection to exchange, while Jacob and the Politico got along reasonably well together once they'd established a neutral ground on which they could speak with no fear of compromising anybody at all, and where no unguarded word could do harm. "God love us," said Joe Place, taking his ease on the quarter-deck a little abaft the wheel. "What a din they do make, to be sure. You would think it was the snuggery of the William at Shelmerston of a Saturday night." "Never mind, mate," said his cousin Bondon. "The port decanters are just put in on the table, and once they've drunk the king, they'll be quieter. They've eaten two whole sucking pigs which weigh on the stomach." There was indeed a pause after all present had murmured, "God bless him," and drunk their wine. And when the talk had regained a moderate pitch, Jacob said to the Politico, "I believe my colleague is anxious to have a word with you." "And I with him, as you may imagine. We've had hardly any news from the other side since the sea went mad." In a reasonably subtle manner, which other people, their neighbours and the servants standing behind their chairs, would not understand, they arranged for a private meeting somewhat later in the day. But their professional cunning was cast away entirely when the party came to an end, and the Admiral quite openly asked Stephen to come with him and speak about his experiences on the Barbary coast and the present state of affairs in Algiers itself. This he did, in as plain and straightforward manner as he could, and Admiral Fanshawe listened gravely with close attention, never interrupting. "Well," he said, when Stephen had finished, "I'm sorry for Omar Pasha. He was a likeable ruffian, But that's one of the risks a day must run. And from the political point of view, I think the Commander-in-Chief will think that we gain from the change. Alibay has always been more in our favour than otherwise, and many English merchantmen have had reason to be grateful for his moderation and indeed his kindness on occasion. But I'm afraid you must have had but a weary time of it over there. Well, sir, that too was one of the risks of my calling. And I did see some very glorious spectacles in the Atlas. The only thing I really did regret, and regret most bitterly, was the spectacle of Surprise's tender trying in vain to beat against that shocking wind when I needed so desperately to bring my news to Mahon. Yet even that extreme vexation of spirit faded when Captain Aubrey assured me that the same blast must necessarily have confined the Moorish galley to her port, so that my anguish had no real basis. It was a shocking blast indeed. All the East India and Turkish ships were blocked in Lisbon, and Lord Barmouth only just managed to get into Gibraltar. Lord Barmouth, sir? Why, yes, he superseded Lord Keith, and it is to him that you will have to address your report. Lord Barmouth? Cried Stephen, startled out of his usual equanimity. Oh, yes, I remember Lady Keith telling Captain Aubrey that her husband didn't wish for a long tenure, but that they should retire to a house near the governor's cottage until the weather in England grew more tolerable. But I hadn't expected it so soon. Nor had I expected Lord Barmouth. You are displeased, Dr. Maturin? Asked the Admiral, smiling. I beg pardon, sir, said Stephen. I have not the slightest right to an opinion on the matter, but I did know that Lord and Lady Keith had a long-standing friendship for Captain Aubrey, and I had hoped that the Admiral would do everything possible and impossible to reinforce his scattered squadron, to make the capture of the Atsila galley more probable. Oh, I'm sure that Lord Barmouth will do his utmost, said Admiral Fanshawe, but as you know, the forces at his disposal are precious thin on the ground. Still, he said, rising after a pause, I do wish you the best of success, and at least you have a fair wind for your voyage.